The moment you have all been waiting for has now arrived. As we enter the holiday season, it is time for conference play in the A-10. So, of course, as we are A-10 Talk, the A-10 Talk podcast, we need to talk about a complete conference play preview. I'm Sam Basil alongside Daniel Frank as usual. Daniel, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Sam. Glad to be back and ready to talk some A-10 hoops and get conference play rolling here.
Yeah, you know, all the time for, you know, projections and predictions and bid talk, we're going to have to put that on hold for a little bit because now we're really getting into probably the best part of the season where, you know, it's just an 18-game gauntlet for our 14 A-10 schools. So before we kind of get into, you know, breaking down where we think all of the A-10 schools stand right now and how they might stand coming out of conference play, let's kind of get into a bit of, you know, what I like to call the gloom and doom section of the podcast, which I think is something that we've kind of been getting into a lot this season for one reason or another. December 30th, which is the day that this podcast will probably be launching, was supposed to be the full conference play opener for the entire A-10 conference. We had 7 games slated for Thursday, but as the week kind of the past week and a half kind of trickled down and you know, new stories coming out about, you know, this new COVID variant and teams all around the country are postponing games, we are now down to just 2 games on Thursday to open up conference play. Daniel, I mean, of course, you know, there's talk about there hasn't really been any talk about cancellations down the road. I think a lot of these cancellations and postponements are kind of precautionary measures, which could be a good thing. But seeing, you know, the slate shrink from 7 to 2, are you a bit concerned for conference play this year?
Yeah, you know, it's concerning. I think we're all having flashbacks to where we were at this point last year, where it was really a crapshoot of whether games are going to get played or not. And it was, you know, whoever was healthy would just play whoever else was healthy. You might play one team like 3 times. It's happened a couple times, I think, last season. I'm trying to stay optimistic. I really want to be optimistic here and think maybe this is just people coming back from Christmas break and whatnot. And, you know, once we get guys in protocol and we can keep guys in a relative bubble that, you know, hopefully, plus with the new COVID protocols, with the CDC guidelines changing, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 weeks, things will settle down and kind of by the time we get to mid-January, early February, hopefully we can get through a fairly decent schedule of, you know, what we already have. But I think it's anyone's guess right now.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of what I'm seeing, a lot of these headlines, you know, the word that they're using for these games not being played is postponed, right? These games are being postponed, trying to figure out what's going to happen with them, maybe play them at a later date. Of course, as I'm sure a lot of you saw, that the A-10, they amended their forfeit policy. Now that if a team can't play a game, the game won't automatically be determined a loss, which I think is a good move. I think, you know, as Jeff Goodman kind of put it, the forfeit policy was more of kind of a punishment for teams that weren't vaccinating their players at a proper rate, which I think in practice or on paper was not too terrible of an idea. I think it was a good way to, you know, incentivize vaccinations. But now seeing that a lot of these new strains of COVID are affecting vaccinated people, there's nothing really you can do. I mean, if you catch it, it's hard to say it's your fault. Yeah. But seeing as how, you know, if you look at a team like Fordham or even a team like St. Louis, who starts their conference slate on Sunday, January 2nd, for the next 3 weeks, they're playing games every 3 days. I mean, if you look at Fordham, they're playing a game on the 30th, the 2nd, the 5th, and then pretty much like that all the way up until January 20th. Even if teams were healthy enough to get another game in, do you think there's just enough time for every team in the A-10 to play 18 conference games this year? Or do you think, you know, it's kind of a long shot for every team in the A-10 to play 18 games?
I'll be happy if we get most of the teams to 16 games, frankly. I don't think, now I'm crossing my fingers, I think last season we had like 50 or 60 games, I think, that just never got played, that were postponed. I'm hoping, I don't think we're going to get to quite that number. I think we're probably going to get to the point where we're going to have 1 or 2 probably a week that get, you know, on any given day of the week that get canceled. But I'm really hoping it doesn't get to that point. But I mean, I think the most interesting thing to me that the conference has done, I guess not done to this point, is they've not done what they did last year with trying to pair healthy teams together. There was talk on Twitter today with what there were five games that got canceled for this coming week. And instead of trying to pair the healthy teams together, the A-10 just said, ah, we're not going to do it. If you want to play a non-conference game, go for it. So Mason won, got Kansas, which major props to Kim English for that. But so a team like Richmond, who is still kind of bubbly, probably outside looking in, but we'll see, is going to be left most likely without a game, which is interesting. But again, I think this is a, something that the Atlantic 10 is going to have to try to evolve and see as things are going throughout the season. If this becomes an issue, if things kind of simmer down, I think unequivocally, if this persists and kind of goes the way of last year, they're going to have to shift gears and say, okay, we're just going to play whoever's healthy. We got to get games in somehow. I don't think they're there yet, but it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up that George Mason Kansas game, because that was something I really want to talk to you about. But first, before we get into that, you mentioned those teams on the bubble. And, you know, to me right now, just the way the A-10 has shaped out in non-conference play, I don't know if bubble is a great term to use, because it feels like a lot of these teams outside of Davidson really aren't on that March Madness bubble. I mean, feel free to disagree with me, but I thought this was a pretty interesting breakdown from Stu Durando, a Billiken's basketball reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I'm sure a lot of you guys who listen to A-10 Talk or follow the Billiken's are familiar with him. Davidson is among the top 50 teams in the NCAA's net rankings. But after that, the Bonnies are at 113, Richmond 79, and St. Louis is at 72. So, you know, if I'm one of those teams, if I'm a Dayton or a St. Louis, you know, what's my goal here? Am I trying to get wins to try and, you know, pick up some props for the Selection Sunday for an at-large bid? Or am I just trying to get games in? And am I just trying to prepare to win the A-10 tournament? Is the prospect for a second at-large bid for the A-10 pretty much wiped away by a lot of these postponements?
I think so, likely. I think this is kind of the direction we headed last year. We narrowly avoided it. I think the biggest thing that's going to matter is how the other conferences are affected as well. I was listening to the Louisville-Wake Forest broadcast tonight before we recorded this show, and Joe Lunardi's projecting only three ACC schools in the field right now. And they were saying that they really are hoping that they can get more of these games in so that they can get, you know, these higher net games in. So for the ACC to get at-large bids, which is, first of all, a bizarre place for them to be in. But I think if the ACC is able to or is not able to get games in, I think that might open the door for the Atlantic 10. The reality is if one conference is having issues, most of them are going to be having issues. That's just kind of how things go. But I do think this probably doesn't play in the Atlantic 10's favor. I think it's always been the recipe for mid-majors across the board to win in volume. More than anything else, yes, you need to have those great wins against the top, whatever RPI net, whatever metric was used at the time. But I think you just need to have the maximum number of wins you can possibly have. And so if they're only going to have some teams that may get 12, 14, 16 conference games, then that's really going to make it difficult. Plus, I just top to bottom, there's not that many opportunities. I mean, you're really going to have things fold, especially for Bonner. I think Davidson, I think, is our best shot at getting an at-large bid right now. I think we're all rooting for Davidson to lose in the conference tournament. Bonner, I still feel like just because their name and their national attention they've gotten this season has a shot to get an at-large. They're going to need help, and they're going to need, if things have to get rescheduled, they're going to need the bad teams to be the one that get COVID, and they're going to need to have the good teams stay healthy so that they can have those extra games. I think that's the only way it happens.
Yeah, and it's crazy, you know, that now Davidson is the team that we're rooting for to lose in the A-10.
Oh, thank you.
Probably like in the semifinals or in the final somewhere. I feel like, you know, over the course of the last 3-4 episodes, it's been a different team in that spot every single time. It's mostly been the Bonnies, but I feel like Dayton's kind of been in there a couple times. But you know what? It's great to see Davidson in there. I mean, they've always been a fun team, and hopefully they'll be a fun team in the NCAA tournament if they finally make it. But you know, kind of moving on from that, the gloom and doom section, the weekly gloom and doom section, I want to circle back to something that you mentioned. So George Mason's game against Kansas on Saturday, I was looking at the conference slate for the weekend, because I was thinking, oh man, you know, I hope there's some maybe games in between Thursday and Sunday. And I wasn't really finding anything on Friday. And then that popped up on my screen for, you know, that the ESPN scores. I'm like, how the hell did that happen? So could you kind of break down what you've heard in terms of how Mason was able to schedule that game?
So basically, Kim English is an absolute legend. He's not afraid to play anyone. Mason was, in effect, replaced games that were supposed to be against Coppin State and Duquesne with a game against Wisconsin, which unfortunately didn't get played, and a game against Kansas. And that's just phenomenal last-minute scheduling. I think Kim English is just throwing the gauntlet down, saying, hey, I'm not afraid to play anyone. And that's going to help Mason long-term. Basically, how things have unfolded for Mason, for folks that haven't followed super closely, they made it through pretty much all of November and middle of December without any COVID issues. And then once it started catching up to everyone else around the country, it caught them as well. So they didn't get the game against Coppin State at home, which was supposed to be their final game, I think, before A-10 play, I believe. That got canceled. They really quickly turned around and got Wisconsin on the schedule. Within 48 hours, they flew out to Madison, had practice day before the game, had shoot around the morning of, and then at like noon local time, found out Wisconsin had gotten COVID, game was off. So they had to fly back to Fairfax same day. And just the whole thing was just a horrible missed opportunity for Mason. I'm still curious about whether Wisconsin's going to foot the bill for that and how the finances of that are going to happen. But that was kind of like an all shucks moment for Mason. But, you know, the coach was like, whatever, we're turning the page, getting ready for VCU. Then obviously things happened this past week. I think it broke on yesterday? Yesterday being as we record this Tuesday. Yeah. That Mason VCU was the first game called off, and then Matt Norlander breaks the other three or four other games that also got called off. And then in the time span of that and like 2 o'clock this afternoon on Wednesday, Kim English got Bill Self on the phone and said, hey, how about? And here we are. So it'll be Saturday at 5 p.m. on ESPN Plus, number 6 Kansas. They have a game tonight, Kansas does, against Nevada. Last I checked, they were up 10. I can double check the score, but they're up 46-31 in the second half right now. So Kansas is likely going to be coming in at 10-1, assuming the score holds, as the number 6 team in the country, which is pretty exciting. Great opportunity for Mason. Plus, Dayton beat them.
Yeah, I was going to say that one coming from Dayton at the ESPN Event Invitational. So, you know, you talk about how this is probably more of a, you know, this is a positive for Mason in more of a sense that they get to just play a top team instead of, you know, really trying to beat a top team. You know, not to knock on Mason at all, but it's pretty tough going up against the 6th best team in the country. But, you know, for Mason fans, there's always a reason to watch your favorite team, even if you think they might lose. So, I mean, even if this game might be a blowout for Kansas, what are some positives for Mason that you think fans should look out for, that you think Mason should be working on in this game against Kansas?
I think more than anything else, the first thing is it's just an opportunity to get on the court, and they've not played in over a week. December 21st was Mason's last game. And if they were not able to get this game on the schedule, they were looking at the possibility of over 2 weeks off, because the next game on the schedule is January 5th. So they were looking at 15 day off if they couldn't get this Kansas game on the schedule between the AU game and what would have been Rhode Island game, assuming that happens, because who knows. But I think that's the biggest thing, is just getting back on the basketball court, getting things back in motion, getting sharp for conference play. My goal for the Wisconsin game, I talked about this with the Giant Killer Riders a lot, of just like, what are realistic goals? I just want Mason to be respectable, keep it close, you know, 10-15 point range I would be satisfied with. I don't want them to get blown out by 40, because you don't want it to be demoralizing. You want to have a good showing. But I think just the opportunity to have, you know, that experience. I mean, yes, they went on the run and beat Maryland. Turns out it wasn't as good as a win as we thought it was at the time. Same with Georgia, who went and lost to Gardner-Webb at East Tennessee State after Mason beat them. But I think anytime you can get a Power 5 school on your schedule, it's going to turn heads. It's great for national exposure. And heck, if Mason even makes it a game, people are going to be talking about Mason again, which is great for the program. And it's a great story for Kim English to just, you know, get the respect of, hey, Kansas will play them. I mean, that's a big thing for Mason.
So as big as this game is, of course, in terms of your actual record, I'm sure you would agree that, you know, conference games are a bit more important right now than maybe a flashy game against Kansas.
For sure.
So the next day, Mason is still scheduled. I haven't seen really any updates on this.
But it's gone.
It's gone. Postponed. They're not playing Duquesne in
Duquesne. Okay. Nope, that's postponed.
Because I was going to say that would have been a pretty big turnaround for Mason. I mean, not that Duquesne is a top tier A-10 team this year, but I mean, well, I guess that's good for them then. So I guess they
Kansas this weekend. It was not. I don't know if that was publicly posted officially. It was in the Mason media notes that they sent out. That the Duquesne game was postponed at the same time that they scheduled. Because I'm assuming what happened is Duquesne was postponed and then Mason was like, well, we're free. We might as well see, is my assumption. But yeah, that wasn't officially announced as publicly as the things were yesterday.
Gotcha.
So as far as I know, it's the only game that is everyone's second game, which would have been Sunday the 2nd for the men. That's the only one that's so far been postponed. We'll keep our fingers crossed. I'm sure others will happen, but we'll see.
But moving on to our next segment, I kind of want to break down the A-10 right now in terms of, you know, where these teams are in their development, where these teams are in their program over the next couple of years, where they are this year, and what their goals realistically should be in this conference play heading into the conference tournament. So, you know, we've got three tiers, Daniel, and I kind of want you to rank them based on these tiers. So the first tier, I would say probably about five teams is the pillow fight, you know, 14 to 10 teams that, you know, are probably not going to make much noise in the Atlantic 10 tournament, teams that may be able to sneak off and win against a big team like Richmond or St. Louis. But, you know, guys that are just trying to build a program and worry about, you know, the next couple of years. So for you, what teams would you put in this year's pillow fight?
I think it's, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of disagreement in this. I think it's pretty clearly GW, LaSalle, Duquesne, and St. Joe's. I think Fordham is clear of that for the moment. Granted, obviously anything can happen in conference play. You know, maybe GW will go undefeated magically. Like that'll happen. But no, GW, I think, is solidly at the bottom there, unfortunately for me as the lifelong GW fan, but everything I've seen from them, just not a good vibe right now. I think LaSalle's in a similar boat, especially losing Sharif Keddie middle of the season. Everything about LaSalle is just a big old pile of yikes at the moment. And then Duquesne, they've been unimpressive to me so far this season. Maybe they sneak up and get some wins. It's possible. I'm not counting them out the same way I kind of am for LaSalle and GW. St. Joe's is kind of the iffy one here. I mean, they have the nice win over Georgetown, which we'll see how good of a win that ends up being at the end of the season. But I'd say that's my bottom tier. But what do you have?
Yeah, I've got Duquesne, LaSalle, GW, and I would probably throw St. Joe's in there as kind of a borderline team. I mean, I think St. Joe's is better than a pillow fight team, but I also think that there are nine teams in the conference that are clearly better. So they have to be in there by default. And so my question to you is, you know, with Jamie and Christian at GW, well, also, you know, let's talk about these four teams as a whole first. You know, they're probably not going to finish with a winning record in A-10 play. They probably won't make it farther than Friday in the A-10 tournament. What is there for any of these teams for fans to keep watching this season? Of course, and I'm not saying that in a condescending way. I'm saying that in a way where I'm trying to figure out, you know, if you're a fan of these teams, I want you to be watching every single game. So what's something that you can find, a storyline that you can pull from any of these teams that would make you want to keep watching maybe a GW or a Duquesne for the rest of the season?
For GW, the case is Breon Freeman. I think he is arguably the best freshman who doesn't play for Dayton in the Atlantic 10 this season. Dayton has nine freshmen or something ridiculous.
Yeah,
but
and they're all great.
They're all phenomenal. But Breon Freeman is a special talent. He should be starting. He's been sixth man off the bench or first man off the bench, the sixth man, for most of the season. And he's been putting up like 18, 20 points a game recently. A phenomenal talent, one that I'm praying Jamie Christian finds a way to keep around for at least another year. Everything about the situation just to me screams like the type of guy that transfers away after one season. I don't have any knowledge. I'm just speculating, but he is a special talent to watch right now for GW fans. I mean, to get to see him in person a couple times, I did this year before GW closed doors to fans, he was just a tremendous talent, and his confidence grew more and more, especially on the California road trip. And then once they got back from that, he's just a fun dude to watch. That's for GW. For LaSalle, I would have said Sharif Kenny. Can't anymore. So I don't. Hey, you got a nice light with them with the smoke machine. That's cool. That's about as good as I have for LaSalle.
I always forget about that light, and every time I see it brought up on Twitter, usually by the Gola boys.
Phenomenal content.
It just cracks me up, man. It's. I don't even know how to describe it. You know, it's almost like it's perfect, I think, for a college team, in the same way that I think a lot of colleges, not just outside of their athletic programs, you know, try to really put some band-aids on some bullet holes. You know what I mean? They, you know, college kids are always stressed out. They've got these finals, and to you know, maybe alleviate some of that pressure, the administration will go, you can have a free cookie in the dining hall. Like,
exactly.
Sorry that you have 10 papers and you want to rip your hair out, but there's one dog on the quad for all 4,000 kids.
This is so spot on. So spot on.
It's, you know, the LaSalle light is the free cookie of A-10 basketball to me. And it's just, at least they're trying, man. I gotta give them some props to that. So moving forward though, for GW, and I think also Duquesne a little bit too. I mean, Duquesne is so weird to me because obviously they're not having a good year this year, but under Keith Dambrow's kind of tenure, they've been okay. They've always challenged. I think that 21-9 season is going to, you know, carry a lot of weight for Dambrow when his contract expires. I think in 2 years, he's in his fifth year of seven, but I don't think enough people talk about how Duquesne really has a lot of the same problems that some of these other bottom A-10 schools have, in that they don't really get the results and they don't really hold on to guys that well. I mean, you look at a guy like Tavian Dunn-Martin, you know, he's doing really well at, you know, elsewhere in Division One. I mean,
Florida Gulf Coast, I think.
I think, yeah, Florida Gulf Coast. I think he lit up Rhode Island a couple weeks
ago. That sounds right.
Yeah, right around the same time the Fordham was down at the Gulf Coast Showcase. So, you know, do you really see a future for Duquesne that Dambrow is a part of? And do you really see a future at George Washington that Jamie and Christian is a part of long term?
Well, for Dambrow, I mean, I'm looking at their resume right now. They're 5-7 right now, which is not great. It's above GW, so there's that. GW's 4-8. They're Duquesne's five wins are Ryder, Bradley, American, New Hampshire, and UC Irvine. Nothing jumps off the page. Their losses are to Hofstra, Weber State, Northeastern, Colorado, Bowling Green, and Marshall, and DePaul. So I gotta say,
even those losses don't really jump out at me.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, they're 5-7, but at least, you know, they got a close one. I mean, Hofstra's a good team, but it's nothing really to say, oh man, we put up a fight against Hofstra.
They took Colorado to overtime. That's basically what they can hang their hat on, what they lost, but
hanging low on the hat rack.
That's about as low as you can get, but it's really, I mean, this is a conversation we've been having about Duquesne for as long as I can remember, basically. I mean, Duquesne is, any talk of Duquesne leaving the Atlantic 10 is just, no, that's not a comment. They are an original member of the league. They're never leaving. And especially, they're also a women's basketball powerhouse traditionally. So no, they're not leaving the Atlantic 10. That's not a conversation. But they shouldn't have as hard a time attracting guys right now as they seem to be, given the fact that they have a very attractive facility right now that they did, the UPMC Cooper Field House. It looks beautiful. The weight room, everything looks beautiful. It's probably above, it's probably the top third in the conference in facilities from what I've seen. And yet they still, the recruiting seems to be just, eh, they're not getting, you know, guys, even they're not even getting like a Breon Freeman type of guy like Jets UW has been able to get. Duquesne and GW are fascinating conversations to me because they have different problems. The problem with Duquesne is talent. I think that's pretty clear. The problem with GW, for the first time in a while, has nothing to do with talent. Ricky Lindo Jr., you know, Joe Bamisil, Breon, all these guys are dudes. They're good players. They're average. I mean, James Bishop led the league in scoring last year. Whole league. And yet, the problem seems to be coaching for GW. I personally would not give Jamie Christian another year after this season. I think he's going to get one more season because that's his contract and they'll probably give it to him. I've talked about this before. I don't know what's going to happen. I think Dan Brock probably gets at least another year or two because I don't think the issue is necessarily his coaching, but again, he's also the recruiter. So it kind of could go either way there.
Yeah. And it's really hard to have these conversations, right? When you talk about coaching changes, I mean, I think, as someone who went to Fordham during Jeff Neubauer's time, everyone's saying, oh, Jeff Neubauer's got to go. But I would say to people, look, I understand that maybe he's not the right fit for this school and we'd probably be better off with a different coach that fits the A-10's playing style. But Fordham isn't the New York Knicks. Duquesne's not the Philadelphia 76ers. They don't have that, disposable income where they can just, you know, keep rotating coaches before their contracts are up. It takes time and it takes a lot of money to make these changes. So, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of these fans are gonna have to play the waiting game and hope that something comes up, you know, before these coaches' contracts run out. But I totally agree. I mean, I don't really see Dan Brough staying that much longer. I really don't see Christian staying that much longer. But for Christian, would you say, it's the problem with GW is a coaching problem? You know, in interviews that I've seen with him, especially at A10 Media Day, he seems like a great guy, like a stand-up guy. So do you think it's something of a team culture problem, or do you think it's more of just, you know, he's kind of behind when it comes to drawing up plays?
Hard to say. I don't want to badmouth Jamie Christian because as a dude, he's a phenomenal dude. I love talking to him. Love, you know, every experience I've had with him as a person has been first class, just such a genuine good dude. Very similar to Maurice Joseph in that aspect. Very, very nice person. Great person you'd want to coach your kid, you know, if you're a parent. Competitively, there just seems to be something that's just not quite there right now. Maybe it's philosophy. I've talked before about, you know, he doesn't always seem to know what to say in a timeout. There were several games I've been to this season where he would not talk for more than 30 seconds in a media timeout, and the team would stand there for like 2 minutes waiting for the timeout to end in close, like the UMass Lowell game, a game they lost at home. Three of the four timeouts in the second half, as I recall, and that were media timeouts. He talked to the team for like 30 seconds and then was like, that's all I have to say. And like, it's not like they were up 40 points. It's like, yeah, there's not much we need to improve on. Like, I could have sat there. In fact, I did in that timeout, picked apart everything they were doing wrong to my father sitting next to me through the whole meet. Like, as a coach, if you're out of things to say, that's a red flag to me because there's always some. I mean, you see like the great coaches, you know, the Bill Selfs of the world, who will be coaching up 40 with 30 seconds left. There's always something you can use as a teachable moment. And to me, schematically, like that, it seems to be indicative of a larger problem with GW where they just don't seem to have an identity at the end of the day. It's going to be, maybe it's James Bishop's night, maybe it's Ricky Lindo's night, but there always seems to be like, yeah, there's one guy who's going to score tonight and no one else is going to do anything. And like, it's just confusing to watch. It really is.
So it sounds like he hands off a lot of the responsibility to his players, maybe too much in some instances. Yeah.
Yeah. And which works at the NBA level, but doesn't as much here.
Well, because, you know, at this level, you're developing guys for the NBA. So these guys,
absolutely,
you know, as smart as some players are, I mean, I think there are plenty of players in college basketball with a high basketball IQ. Even those guys, they need the help. I mean, that's why guys like, I mean, of course they have to, you know, according to the NCAA rules or the NBA's rules. But I mean, everything those guys learn in college is so valuable. So you do need to be there for those guys. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, always having something, always finding something to talk about with your players. I think a great example of that is maybe outside the A-10 with Rick Pitino. I went to the Hall of Fame Invitational at the Barclays earlier on this December, which was the last time Fordham played actually against Miami. They haven't played a game since about, I think, it's December 12th. Because they were already going to be at a long break. They were going to be on a 10-day break to go play, for finals and to play Georgia Southern. But that game ended up getting canceled. So they're on an almost, I think that they're on a two and a half week pause right now, you know, opening up their season on Thursday. But Rick Pitino, Iona was playing Yale, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of, it was the last game of the night. You know, I don't think a lot of people really cared about Yale. So it was pretty empty in the Barclays Center. So you can kind of hear a lot of stuff from the press box. If you were just listening to what Rick Pitino was saying to his players as they were up, you know, 30, 40 points, you would have thought that they were down 50. It was absolutely insane. But I mean, I think that's just the testament to how great of a coach he is.
He's easily top five coach in the country.
Oh, easily. Yeah, easily. One of my favorite things he said that wasn't really like a coaching moment, but more of just, you know, a great coach also stands by his guys all the time. You know, as much as he'll yell at them personally, but there was a point where a ref made a foul call, and he just looked the ref in the eye and said, "You made that up. That's not a rule." And the whole arena was like, "Whoa, Rick! Like, come on, man!" But you know, hopefully, in kind of these bottom tier teams in the A-10, we'll see some more positive coaching changes. Whether or not these coaches get it together, or we see, you know, some new faces in the future. So the next tier I kind of want to talk to you about is, you know, conference tournament challengers, not really guys that we think will steal an automatic bid or guys that, you know, will even or are even close to qualifying for an at-large bid. But, you know, that team, that St. Joe's, that UMass, that can kind of challenge on the first 2 days of the tournament, that kind of gets everyone talking, and that could, you know, use that performance to, you know, sneak a spot, maybe the NIT. So for me, I think that's kind of the widest portion of the conference. So for me, I've got probably four or five teams. I've got UMass, Mason, Fordham. They're in second place in the conference in terms of non-conference play, but I'm going to throw Rhodey in there too. And VCU as well. Because VCU is kind of having like a weird off year, and I don't really think that they can really do much with their current roster. But let me hear yours, Daniel.
I have pretty much the exact same. I think for the purposes of just separating everything, I think Davidson, Bonna are kind of a league of their own. And then you kind of have, like, if we're sub-tiering this, you have Davidson, Bonna, and then like Rich and Slow Dayton, I think. So I think the same bunch that you have, the Rhodey, VCU, UMass, Mason, and Fordham, I think are all approximately in the same boat. Fordham's probably, and UMass are probably the bottom of that. Mason's probably like the middle. And then like VCU and Rhodey are like towards the top of that tier, I think.
Yeah. And then St. Joe's is kind of like floating in the middle of the bottom.
Yeah. Tier. But I think VCU, I've said this time and time again, is like the villain. If you didn't see them die on screen, they're not really dead. VCU is having a weird season. They're going to make the semifinals. I bet you anything they're going to make the A-10 semis. That's just what they do. Like, if we're talking about what team that is going to have a single bye, starts on Thursday in the second round, what team's going to make it to Saturday, it's going to be VCU. Maybe it's Rhode Island. But if all the teams, it's probably VCU.
Yeah, I mean, because VCU always, I mean, I think teams that always find themselves in that situation are the teams that kind of play like disruption ball. And I mean, VCU has always been a team like that, guard heavy, very fast pace. And, you know, I don't really think, you know, even without Bones, I don't really think that identity's changed much. And Richmond, realistically, I guess I would put Richmond in that tier. But I just think they have to try and do something in this year's tournament. So that's why I put them in my highest tier. My highest tier is a bit bigger than yours. I definitely think Davidson and the Bonnies are in a league of their own. But in terms of a conference tournament, I also have SLU, Dayton, and Richmond in that tier because I do think those are all teams that I think really could contend for a conference championship. SLU is kind of a problem because, I mean, they're having their injury problems, so I think they'd be a lot higher if they were healthy. And their recent stretch, I think they've lost three of their last four. That's been pretty tough for them. So, I don't know. I would really have to see. But, I mean, do you think it's impossible for Dayton to be a tournament team this year? Their net ranking is so strange. I mean, if you look, they do have the most quad one wins out of any team in the A-10. They're 3-0 against quad one teams. Davidson is 2-0 against quad one teams. I mean, that one against Alabama was excellent. But, I mean, in terms of just raw numbers, Dayton's got the most. But then they're 0-2 in quad two, 1-0 in quad three, and then 4-3 in quad four. So when I look at their resume, when I look at their, you know, kind of their net breakdown, they just scream inexperience to me. So
if Dayton's season started the third week of November like it did last season, Dayton is absolutely an at-large bid. Do you take away the first 2 weeks of the season, Dayton is absolutely top two teams in the conference right now.
Yeah.
They're probably even would be ahead of the Bonnies right now if you take away the first 2 weeks of the season. The problem is we can't take that away. The loss to Lipscomb and, you know, that's going to just break. I don't think they have an at-large shot, seriously, just purely based on the fact that there's not enough opportunities left for them to get, you know, those high-quality wins you'd need to get to the NCAA tournament.
Even against Davidson, even if they pull something off against Davidson?
Dayton realistically needs to make the A-10 finals and probably go in a perfect world in which there's no COVID. Say we go there of an 18-game season. They probably need to go 16-2 or 15-3 and then make the A-10 finals, I think, to have a legit shot as an at-large. With COVID,
that's a big ask.
God only knows. Yeah. It's possible, but I'm not holding my breath.
And with Richmond, to me, I mean, you know, it's something that we see every single year. I mean, they're such an experienced team, but they just
same story, different year.
They don't come up. They just don't come up in big moments. Every time they're ready to go in a big moment, they flounder. And I feel like every final A-10 tournament press conference with Chris Mooney it's depressing in a way. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh, you know, we got all the way. And then we just came up short. So that's why I have them kind of floating in the middle. But I just think if they really hunker down, they could do it. But with St. Bonaventure, I mean, you know, without Kyle Lofton, I mean, how far do you see this team going?
It's tough to say. I think Bonaventure's biggest problem is their depth, which may or may not hurt them given how, you know, especially as COVID progresses and we, you know, who knows if we're going to see some teams playing with the minimum of what, the seven players and one coach. It's certainly possible we see that. If Bonna gets a more even playing field, it's theoretical that it's not going to hurt them. If they get 18 games in, which they're not going to, but hypothetically that would hurt them more. Honestly, there's a possibility here that this actually works in Bonna's favor in the regard that if they have stretches where they don't have games, they can kind of space things out. That may help them with having a shorter bench. I'm not writing Bonna off by any means. I think they're still, you know, top two team in the conference, easily could win the A-10 tournament, especially because Davidson is, you know, I don't think anyone is a deadlock. This is definitely not a 2020 Dayton year where there's like it's Dayton and there's everyone else. Like, I don't think the conversation that anyone's having is it's Davidson and everyone else, or it's Davidson, Bonn, and then everyone else. Like, Richmond, SLU, Dayton, all of those, VC, Rhodey, have a shot at making a run at this thing. And it's going to be really fascinating to see, you know, how this all plays out. And it's all going to boil down to who stays healthy, both from injury and COVID. I mean, it just, who knows?
Yeah, I you know, you bring up the requirement 7 players and one coach. I don't know if this is just me, but I think it's crazier to think of a team playing with just one coach on the bench, more than just having 2 guys on the bench. I mean, I guess both are pretty crazy, but I mean, you know, as you know, being at a any college basketball game, you see, you know, the different personalities of every coach on the bench and how much they contribute. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how much of a factor that plays into, you know, the results of a game. But, you know, moving on from the men's side, I feel like in this conversation I said in the beginning we were moving away from the doom and gloom, and then we sort of kind of circled back into it. But it's really hard to not when talking about the Atlantic 10 on the men's side this year. But hopefully something a bit lighter. We're gonna go over these tiers once again on the women's side of things, as the women's teams enter conference play. So, Daniel, right now, how many bids do you think the A10 is up for in, you know, in the women's tournament this year?
Realistically, there are 4 teams that have a shot. It's UMass, Fordham, Dayton, Rhode Island. I think realistically, in terms of number of bids, it's likely to be 2, which would be massive. The conference hasn't been multi-bid league in going on 6, 7 years now. So getting 2 teams for the women would be absolutely massive. UMass is by far in the driver's seat for that at the moment. They are, I believe, they're 47th in the net right now, and they are 10, they're sorry, they're 12 and 2. They have 5 players averaging double figures, and Sam Breen leads the nation in rebounding, which is just phenomenal. She could realistically be the best A10 women's player we have seen come through this conference since Jonquel Jones at GW, which is a hell of a comparison I'm making because JJ just won WNBA Player of the Year this past season for the Connecticut Sun. Sam Breen is a special talent with special players around her and a very special coach as well, Torrey Verity. UMass has all the makings to be a Sweet 16 team, possibly. I'm not saying they're going to get there, but they have the right ingredients that they could not only get to March, which would be the first time in a while for them, but they have the ingredients to make some noise once they get there too. I think Fordham has the benefit of the experience. They have, you know, the coaching that and other players that have experienced what it takes to be, and Dayton's in the same boat as well. Dayton has the makings of players that have played in the tournament, won the A10 tournament. Some of them didn't get to play in the NCAA tournament because they won it in 2020. Because the A10 women got their whole tournament in 2020 because they played a week before the men. So they got the whole tournament done before COVID hit the first time. But Dayton's another team that has all the makings. They have so much veteran players of training, Jenner Jaconi, Erin Whalen, just all these players that have come back, in addition to building off of young talent, which has really helped Dayton to some really nice wins this season. They have some Big Ten wins. They have one over Purdue. I think they also have a win over Illinois, if I'm not mistaken. They only have 3 losses. Their worst loss is a home loss to Duke, which is not a bad loss. All their losses are to Power Five schools. So there's absolutely no shame in that, which is also the case for UMass. UMass has 2 losses. They have a tough, close loss at home to Boston College. And then their only other loss was a 2-possession loss to at the time, number 14, Iowa State, who's a very good team. So UMass has shown that they can be competitive at the highest level. Fordham has won over Michigan State this year. One of their only losses is a road loss to Notre Dame. And then the fourth team I haven't yet talked about is Rhode Island. They were kind of last year's surprise team. They've been pretty steadily building. They had a stretch of 3 straight losses, which is their only losses. They're 10-3. They were not horrible losses, and their net is still surprisingly high given those losses. They're 60 in the net, which is obviously below, you know, the range of an at-large most likely. But it's conceivable they could still try to make their way into that conversation. But really, I think at the end of the day, the secret, the recipe for the A10 this year is UMass loses in the conference tournament. They get there, you know, to probably the semifinals, and then someone else comes in and steals that at-large bid, or sorry, the automatic bid, and gets this conference back to being a multi-bid league again. But there's just so much good ball up and down all the way through the conference being played right now. There's been a lot of surprise teams having a lot better seasons than they were projected to, and it's really been exciting to watch.
Yeah, and so you mentioned I was actually just going to ask that too. I mean, UMass, it's clear that UMass is set for an auto bid, or set for an at-large bid out of anybody in the A-10. So now you're kind of rooting for UMass to maybe make it to the semifinals, to the finals, maybe drop out for a bigger team, for another team to get that auto bid. What team are you rooting for? Is it Fordham? Is it Rhodey? I mean, what team do you think has the best chance outside of UMass for making a deep run into the NCAA tournament?
It's interesting. I would also throw in, for the purposes of this, of being if you're talking about bid stealers, I would throw Davidson and VCU's name in the ring as well. VCU is a tougher sell, I think, for folks because of their 5-5 record. They had a top 15 team in South Florida on the ropes at home at the Siegel Center. They led by like 20 points in the third quarter. Blew it. If they had that win, I think we're having a very different conversation about VCU, but they have some really nice pieces there. And Davidson is 9-3, was one of the few teams in the country that really didn't have a whole lot of roster turnover. And they just have some really great scorers and some really great freshmen that have come in and been immediate impactors as well. And just been a really solid team. And I mean, last year that was UMass. UMass was kind of came out, they were the 7th seed, if I remember correctly, in the A-10 tournament, and took out 2 of the top 4 seeds to get all the way to the finals before they kind of ran out of gas and VC won on their home floor. But it's really wide open. It's hard to write off any team like Fordham or Dayton that has, especially Dayton, that has so much experience coming back. But Rhodey's hungry, and I think it'll be interesting to see how Rhode Island bounces back and how they start conference playoff. We were supposed to get, right off the bat, a Rhode Island-Dayton matchup on New Year's Day, which unfortunately the A-10 women are kind of now being hit with the same thing that the men are having issues with. So 4 games on opening day, which was supposed to be New Year's Day for them, have been postponed. Davidson, Fordham, UMass Mason, LaSalle VCU, and Rhode Island-Dayton. So the 4 teams with COVID issues are Davidson, Mason, VCU, and Rhode Island. So again, they're very much a similar boat from a COVID perspective, but I think there's just so much good basketball being played all the way up and down. And I'll say this, especially as frustrating as it is to have your men's team be on pause. You know, you talk about a team like Fordham that's had a really long drought between games, someone like Dayton as well. Now's a great time to tune in and see what your women's team is doing as well, because especially when your men are on pause and you're like, oh man, there's no blah, blah, blah basketball. There's so much good basketball being played in the Atlantic 10 at the women's level, on the women's side. I highly suggest anyone take a look at least watch 1 or 2 games of your school this year, because there's some really high level ball being played.
And so you mentioned that, especially for some of these teams that are on the bottom of the men's side, Duquesne, George Washington, St. Joe's, you know, for fans of those schools, I mean, you know, you didn't really mention them in terms of the top teams, but in terms of George Washington's women's team, in terms of Duquesne's women's teams, you know, is there anything right now to look forward for any of those teams?
For GW, absolutely. Caroline McCombs, I've been saying her name wrong for 2 months, and I'm just now learning I've been saying it wrong. Caroline McCombs is in her first season at GW and has put together a really solid unit. There's been a lot of adapting on the fly. I think there's 9 new players or something ridiculous. Like that. So it's been a learning curve, naturally, as you'd expect, meshing all these new pieces together. They recently had a great story this past week with one of their walk-ons who had not played a single minute. Maxine Engel, I think is her name, who hadn't played a single minute the whole season, had to come in because they were like down to like 7 players because of COVID, and had a phenomenal game and won A-10 Freshman of the Week, which was just a great story. For GW to get that. Maxine Engel is her name. So GW, there's a lot of room for optimism right now. Duquesne's having another frustrating season because of injuries. They cannot escape the injury bug for whatever reason. But Dan Burt is a heck of a coach, and he's gonna get them turned around. He just needs to keep his players on the floor. That's just been the biggest issue. And St. Joe's, has arguably one of the best coaches in the conference. They're just a young team that's building. They've got a lot of young pieces. And you can never count them out. I mean, even, you know, their record right now isn't all that great. They are 4-7, which again, it's not horrible, but you know, anytime you have a Cindy Griffin coach team, you got to keep an eye out for them because there just is no rolling over a Cindy Griffin coach team.
Of course. And I mean, you know, it sounds like going forward, there's going to be a lot of good stuff in A-10's women's basketball. And, you know, as long as the men can stay healthy, a lot of good stuff going forward, A-10 men's basketball. So, you know, if you're looking to stay updated on everything, A-10 men's and women's, make sure you come back to A-10 Talk. Keep listening to the A-10 Talk podcast. Follow all of us on Twitter. Once again, I'm your host, Sam Basil, alongside Daniel Frank. And we'll see you next time, guys.